Welcome to Spirit of the Camino, a podcast about the unique and magical experience that is the Camino de Santiago. Join us on this adventure and discover the spirit of the Camino for yourself.
Hello, and welcome back to the Spirit of the Camino podcast with Nick and Wendy. And we are back from another Camino.
Another Camino?
Just a little one. It does feel like only, well, it was only just a few weeks ago that we were recording our episodes about Fatima, but we've managed to sneak in a little Camino in the meantime, and so we're here to talk about it today.
Yeah, and this one actually went to Santiago, so we got to end both in Fatima and Santiago on two different Caminos this year.
Indeed. So the Camino that we have just completed is the Camino Inglés, that is the English Way, which we took from Ferrol to Santiago, and so it's around 113 kilometers. It took us 6 days, and this time, for the first time in our Camino lives, we went with other people. Mm-hmm. And so we went with our friend Haley and her daughter Samantha, and it was their first Camino, and so it was really great to be able to share that with them and to see it from their perspective, being on the Camino for the first time and things like that.
It was, although we have done that with Darren before as well.
I guess we have, but Darren, you know, he hikes all the time, and we've hiked with him before, so it was a bit different with him.
Yeah. No, I agree that it really felt like seeing it through fresh eyes this time and being with someone who was really excited about it and, you know, taking photos at the Mahon of every time we reached another 10 kilometers closer to Santiago, they would take a photo together, and which was really cute and sweet. And, you know, we're perhaps a bit more jaded at this point because we've done quite a few Caminos, so we didn't have that kind of enthusiasm. But that, well, I mean, we love the Camino, but perhaps in a different way. But it was really great to see that enthusiasm and to see it through new eyes.
Definitely. So the Camino Inglés has two different routes, one starting from A Coruña and one starting from Ferrol. And these two routes then join up at a certain point about halfway through. And what we chose to do was to go from Ferrol because, in fact, if you go from A Coruña, it's only about 72, I think, kilometers. And so that's not enough to receive the Compostela at the end. And that was important, especially for Haley and Samantha being their first Camino, that they wanted to receive the Compostela. And we like getting Compostelas.
Yeah, for sure. We always get one every time we are entitled to one. You know, if we've walked all the way into Santiago, then we will go to the pilgrim's office and get one. I know that some repeat pilgrims don't do that. They get to a point where they just feel like they don't need any more Compostelas, which is fair enough. And we don't do it for the Compostela, but it is something nice to have, for sure.
Definitely. And so we went to A Coruña first, and that's where we actually met up with Haley and Samantha because they had flown in to the airport at A Coruña. So we spent a little bit of time there, and then we took a bus to Ferrol, and then we started walking from there. And so that was basically our Camino plan. You know, a lot of people do the Ferrol to Santiago stretch in 5 days. If you look, for example, at Gronce, they have a stage list of 5 stages. We chose to do it in 6 stages because we just had that extra day available to us. Haley had to take off work to come and do this, but taking essentially a weekend and a whole week, and the following weekend, we were able to have 6 walking days. And we thought that that was worthwhile doing because it allowed us to start off a little bit slowly and mm-hmm. then kind of build up as we were going along. Because if you do the first day that's suggested from Ferrol, it's about 27 kilometers to the town that I have trouble pronouncing because it's a Gallego name, which is
Pontedeume.
Ponte de Ome, there you go. I'm always thinking of saying puente in Spanish instead of ponte in Gallego.
Yeah, well, it's actually a river called the Eome. And so there is a bridge, a ponte, at that point that goes over the Eome. So that's where you get the name Ponte de Ome.
Okay, so the typical first stage goes to that town, and it's about 27 kilometers. You can cut that shorter by taking a bridge. There's a pedestrian bridge, which is next to a railroad. And you can make that shorter by a few kilometers. I'm not sure exactly how many. And so we thought about that at one point, but we thought, let's just walk the whole thing. We have the extra day, so we don't have to be in a hurry. And we can stop before that town on the first day and then sort of continue a bit further the second day and then eventually get back on the stages that are typical by the end.
yeah, I was glad that we did that. I mean, even for myself, if we had walked all the way to Ponte de Ame, that would have been, what, 27, 28 kilometers, which is a long day for me. And I think certainly for our, you know, first time pilgrims who were walking with us, it would have been a really long day for them. Yeah, it's not recommended to start out, you know, really pushing yourself on the first day, and then that could lead to injuries or just exhaustion. So I was glad that we were able to kind of ease ourselves in that way.
Right, so it was a 6-day Camino for us, and in this episode we're going to talk about the highlights of the Camino, some practicalities, and, as we tend to do, some little things to discuss at the end.
Okay, let's get into it.
All right, so if we start with some of the highlights of the Camino Inglés, what are some of the things that you liked about it?
Well, in terms of, you know, locations, places that we passed along the way, Betanzos, the town of Betanzos, was a town that I definitely heard the name lots of times and just had the idea that it was a really nice place in Galicia that would be worth visiting. I didn't know very much at all about it or what there was to see there, but just, you know, looking briefly at names of towns that we would pass along the way, as soon as I saw Betanzos, I thought, oh yeah, I think that's a place worth visiting. And it was. I would say that was probably the most beautiful town that we passed through.
Yeah, definitely. I would agree. And so it's a town that has a historic core. There's several churches and one church complex in particular, San Francisco, which is very much worth visiting. And it was just nice to be in and around the town, you know, and it's a typical Spanish town in a way because it has, you know, lots of bars out in the main plaza and things like that. And so we were able to spend a nice afternoon and evening there. And, you know, there are also galerias and things like that. So, yeah, it was a typical sort of historical Galician town. And, yeah, we enjoyed it.
Yeah, galerias, not in the sense of, like, art galleries, but particular architectural feature that you find in Galicia. And I think particularly in that northern part of Galicia, in A Coruña especially, we saw some really impressive, you know, examples of this architecture. And in Betanzos, which is actually very close to A Coruña. So these are, what do we call them in English? Winter gardens? So it's kind of an enclosed balcony that's enclosed, you know, with glass. So what you see from the outside, they look like glass houses with white frames typically. And they're really beautiful. And that's actually not how I pictured Betanzos. Like, once I did read up about it and saw that it was historic, this historic town, I imagined more stone. I imagined it looking more like Ourense or Pontevedra or Tui. But, and it did, like, you know, the churches, for example, were built in that typical stone. But then you had lots of galerias as well, which kind of adds a lot more light and brightness to it.
Yeah, so that was the historical highlight of the Camino, let's say. I found that the Camino probably didn't have as many of those types of places as I may have hoped, just because I'm a big fan of history and I like going to places like that. And so I thought it was a little bit lacking in similar places. Betanzos was really nice, and it would have been nice for me if there were a couple of other places like that.
Yeah, I think that's fair enough. Ponte de Ame did look nice. We didn't stop there. We just walked straight through, basically. And there was a huge party going on in town because the local football team, from what we had been told, had just been promoted from the C League to the B League. So, yeah, it was a gigantic street party. It was quite loud and raucous, but also, you know, really gave our friends a flavor of Spanish culture. And they saw that repeatedly throughout, and they really loved that. They loved all the parties that were always happening and how festive everything was.
Yeah, it was a great example of the spontaneity of Spanish culture and the sort of serendipitous nature of the Camino, that you might be walking through a place and you had no idea that there was a local festival, or in this case related to football, and suddenly you're just hit with, yeah, all these sounds and people and music and all that kind of stuff. So yeah, that was really fun to walk through that, even though it was a little bit difficult or a bit awkward because we were, you know, walking with our packs and trying to get through this crowd of people, and they were all celebrating. And I think at one point I bumped into something and knocked over
You broke a glass.
I broke a glass of a bar.
But no one cared. They were like, it's okay.
And so that's what Spain is like. And so, yeah, it was definitely fun to walk through and see that. Some of the other things that were highlights for us. Firstly, you do begin in Ferrol. It's along the coast. It's on the north coast. And of course, that's why it's the English Way, because that's where boats would have docked or did dock during the medieval time. And so therefore, pilgrims from England took the boat and then left the boat at Ferrol or A Coruña or one of these other ports in that area and then walked the remainder of the way to Santiago. And so the very first day you're walking along what's called a ría in Galego. I don't know if that's Galego or
that Spanish. Is Galego and also Portuguese. I imagine it's the same in Spanish as well, but I'm not totally sure.
And so a ría is not a río, which is a river, but it's an estuary. And there are quite a lot of these in Galicia. For example, when you're on the Variante Espiritual, if you take the boat trip in the wake of Santiago, you're also on a ría for a period. And so it's just kind of common up there that you have these harbors or harbor type things that come in from the ocean. And then a lot of the cities are built around these, like Vigo, for example, is built also on a ría.
Yeah, yeah. Kind of like a fjord. I've never been to Norway. I've never seen the fjords there, but at least from a geographical point of view, that's what I imagine a fjord to be, is this kind of inlet where the ocean kind of juts into the land and kind of becomes a really wide river for a little while.
Right. So for our first day and a half of the stages that we walked, we were walking alongside that ría, that estuary, for a lot of the walk, which was cool. And then we came to a couple of beaches on the second day, and we had lunch at a beach, which is quite nice. And it was very interesting because there were wild wheat stalks just growing right there on the beach. And so they were kind of intermingled with the sand, and that I found unusual, but also quite picturesque. And so we had lunch there. And then later that night, we stayed in a town called Minho, and that was also on the water. And by this point, it's the ocean, I believe. It's not the ría anymore. Mm-hmm. And there was a beach there. And Haley, our friend, actually said that was her favorite place in terms of the actual places that we went to, was Minho, because we had a hotel that was right near the beach, and she could go and just watch the activity that was going on, you know, people there in the early evening and whatnot. And so it was light still at 10 p.m., 10:30 p.m. And so the sun was going down, and she was taking these strolls along the beach and just sort of watching the sun and the people going about their business and whatnot. And then she got up again the next morning and did a little walk along the beach even before we started our walking for the day. And so that was also a really nice place. And we had probably our best meal of the Camino there as well in the restaurant of the hotel. And they opened the restaurant especially for us.
Yes. When we arrived quite late that day. It was almost 8 o'clock by the time we got into the rooms. And so I was really hoping we could just eat at the hotel and, you know, not have to go looking for something else. And they initially said that only the cafeteria was open. So just kind of simple tapas type dishes, raciones. But then they did actually say, okay, if you want to order in advance, here's the proper restaurant menu and tell us what you want, and then we can prepare it for you later, which was great. I was very appreciative that they did that.
And so one of the other things that was an unexpected highlight, and of course the Caminos are always full of unexpected highlights, and if you've been following us for a while, you know that we do like our fruit that we can pick off wild trees while we're walking on the Camino.
Yes.
And so 3 years ago, when we walked the Camino Portugués in late summer, we were able to pick figs right off wild fig trees. And then 2 years ago, when we walked the Camino Nascente, we were able to pick cherries, which is still just something I think about all the time, that we were just picking these cherries off these wild trees. And they were perfectly in season. And we had no idea in advance that we were walking through the cherry capital of all of Portugal right at peak cherry season. That was really incredible.
Yeah, and you didn't even think you liked cherries, but now you're a big cherry fan.
Oh yeah, now I buy them all the time.
Yeah.
And so the equivalent for this year for our Camino Inglés were plums. And they were very small plums, and I don't know a lot about plums, but I don't know if it's a different variety of plum.
It must be.
But when we first saw the first tree, just from a distance, we weren't really sure what the fruit was.
I mean, they looked like cherries. They were about the size of cherries.
Cherries.
Okay, yeah. But yeah, large cherries. They were the size of large cherries. And more or less the color of cherries as well. But the tree that they were growing on did not at all look like a cherry tree. So it turned out that they were plums, and yeah, it turned out to be plum season. So yeah, I hope this trend continues, and each Camino we discover a new fruit that happens to be in season. This one, I really enjoyed the plums.
Yeah, and we were able to pick some plums off wild trees, but then also something happened, which I actually missed it because I was behind taking pictures of something, but then something that you saw, and you were waiting actually for me because there was a fork in the road, mm-hmm. I guess, and there was a mahon with the indication of the distance to Santiago. And what happened then?
Then a local man came over and had a big box of these plums, and he left them on the top of the mahon for the pilgrims who were passing by for them to eat. So, yeah, I assumed that they came out of his garden and he just had more plums than he knew what to do with, but still, you know, went to the trouble of actually picking them all.
And it was a big tray. There were dozens and dozens of plums there.
Yeah.
So we took them all.
No, we did not.
No, we didn't. We just took a couple of them, just took a handful and went on our way. But that was just one of those, not, you know, such a lovely little moment on the Camino where you see that people are looking out for the pilgrims and providing a little something for them if they have the ability to do so. And it was very much appreciated by us.
Yeah, and we had other experiences like that as well. You know, people who had set up kind of impromptu stands, donativo stands, where they were offering drinks and food, and you just leave whatever donation you would like, and, you know, they have tables and chairs set up. And so we had another really nice experience at one of those places where the man talked to us for quite a while. He was quite a talker.
Carlos, yes.
Carlos, yeah.
He was. And yeah, his stand in particular was almost reminiscent of the famous stand on the Camino Frances, which is David's stand near Astorga. It wasn't quite like that, but yes, it was a donativo. He had drinks, he had some fruit, and he had other sorts of things, and he just comes every day, opens his stand, he has a stamp, and you sit down, and yeah, he tells you stories about various things, and, you know, he has a little, what would you call it, a little shack, mm-hmm. that's there where he must, you know, keep some of his produce or some of the things that he then puts out. And that shack has been painted with street art that's about the Camino on both sides. And then he takes a photo of all the pilgrims if they agree to it. And he's very careful to ask if we agree to it, that he'll take a photo and then put it on the Facebook page that he has for his little stand. And so, yeah, there were a lot of those little, dare I say, spirit of the Camino type of places.
I think you can say that.
And that was really great for us because, you know, we've walked recently a lot more remote Caminos and sometimes we don't get that.
Yeah, when we walk, for example, in Ascent and, yeah, other remote Caminos, we don't meet pilgrims. We may not ever meet a pilgrim. You know, there are very few albergues, so yeah, you really don't feel much spirit of the Camino because there's no pilgrims and the local people don't really know about pilgrims or the Camino. So it's really nice to, it was really nice on the Ingles to be in a place where people did know perfectly well what you were doing and were supporting you along the way.
Yeah, and I felt that was quite prevalent throughout the whole Camino. You know, there was a lot of street art about the Camino, mm-hmm. and some really cool pieces that we really, really liked. And it always just gives you that extra motivation, that extra little push. I don't know if you're part of the way through a long day and you're feeling a bit tired and then you see a nice piece of street art showing a pilgrim or showing a shell or an octopus eating a shell, or we saw something weird like that.
I don't know if he was eating a shell.
He was eating the mahon.
He was wrapped around the mahon.
And it just gives you, yeah, a little extra push to keep going on your way. And we saw other places, other little donativo places that sold or that had shells or had other little pieces of jewelry on, I don't even know if you'd even call it jewelry, but just mm-hmm. little bracelets and things like that. And again, donativo, you could just put in some coins and as much as you thought was necessary or was fair for what you were going to take and things like that. And so it's always really nice to see that kind of stuff, I think.
Yeah.
And so that was one of the things that we really, really liked about the Ingles, was to have that spirit of the Camino and to share it with our friends and to show them all the things about Galicia that we know from the other walks that we've done, and pointing out things like Orrios, mm-hmm. things like, well, the Galerías that you mentioned before, and other aspects of Galician life.
Yeah, and the food. They weren't that familiar with Spanish food, so we got to introduce them to a number of different dishes. So, yeah, I think they really enjoyed it, and I think it was also really good for us to, like I said, you know, see it through their eyes and get a fresh perspective on things.
Okay, moving on to some practicalities of the Camino Ingles. There are a couple of things that people tend to say in general, and I'd be interested to get your view on it. One, that it has a fair bit of asphalt. Mm-hmm. And two, that it has quite a bit of elevation change, ups and downs. Mm-hmm. So we'll start with the asphalt because you're our asphalt correspondent here on the podcast. Because as we've talked about many times, the hardness of the surface is very important to how you deal with your plantar fasciitis. So mm-hmm. what did you think about the surfaces in general and the asphalt in particular?
I agree that there is a lot of asphalt on this Camino. Very fortunately for me, my plantar fasciitis was under control pretty well for all of this Camino. I really had very little pain this time, which was fantastic. I'm not entirely sure why that was and how to replicate it. It may have been because I had been doing exercises for a long time going into it, or it may have been partly that we were doing shorter days. But in any case, I didn't have that much problem myself with the asphalt, but there definitely was a lot of asphalt. And if I had tried to do that at other times, I'm not sure that I could have even finished this Camino, because there have been times when, you know, just walking for a kilometer or two on asphalt has been extremely painful. So, if asphalt is a problem for you, then this might not be the Camino for you.
That's actually the reason why Darren and I last year chose not to do the Inglés. We were going to do it after the Salvador, and we sort of read up about it and saw that there was asphalt, and we said, oh, let's do something else instead. And so we went and did the end of the Portuguese. Yeah, well, it feels like this season is a bit of an asphalt kind of season for us after the Camino to Fatima. But I had problems with the asphalt going to Fatima because I had the wrong shoes, basically. But I felt that there was a lot of asphalt on the Inglés, but it didn't bother me really in the slightest. But yeah, sometimes you would be on a kind of a country road type of thing and you'd think, why is this asphalt? Mm-hmm. Like, it didn't seem like it was really a car road, mm-hmm. and it was a rural sort of path, or you think that it would be perfect just for a dirt path, and it wasn't. In addition to sometimes you were walking alongside some actual roads with cars, which is inevitable. But yeah, sometimes when you think you should be off-road, you were still kind of on-road.
Yeah. Another thing that might be worth mentioning is that they did change the route of the Camino Inglés quite a bit in 2017, apparently. And Gronce has a couple of places where they offer an alternative, so which is following the old path, which is typically longer, but more scenic, and in many cases, you know, not on asphalt, as opposed to the new path being on asphalt. So we took those alternatives a couple of times. There was one that we didn't take just because we had already taken one that day and it was already a long day, and so we didn't want to make it even longer.
Well, the other thing about that one was we were going to miss a fork in the road where we didn't know which way we were going to go, because actually these alternatives that Gronce suggests, or the old route, it's not really that much longer. So you often have, when you're faced with an alternative, this idea of going, as we've talked about already in this season, going longer on a more beautiful way or shorter on a more direct way, but maybe on the road. But if you download the tracks from Gronce, they have their alternative. It's marked in a different color. It's very easy to follow. And then with the descriptions that they give, you can make the decision for yourself as to which way you want to go. And for this first one in particular that I'm talking about, they were very adamant that you should absolutely take the old way and not take the new way, which they said, among other things, was dangerous because it's on quite a main road, mm-hmm. and there's no shoulder. They said we didn't walk it, so we don't know because we took the alternative that they suggested. But mm-hmm. they were very adamant about that. And sometimes Gronce will do that, and in the cases where they're very adamant, we say, okay, we'll do whatever you tell us to do, because you've obviously done both and you have very strong opinions about which one is better. Mm-hmm. With the second one, they sort of said, well, neither way is really that great, actually, so do whatever you want, basically. But friend of the show, Elle Beeling, who writes her travel or her Camino books at pilgrimagetraveler.com, she was very adamant in that case to take the old alternative as well. And so that's what we did. But the old alternative was actually on asphalt as well.
Yeah, I didn't expect it to be. So that was, yeah, a bit of a disappointment. But I think it was still better than the new route, because the new route is right alongside the highway. Although, from what I saw, it's actually not on asphalt. It is a dirt path, but it's a dirt path right next to the highway. So, you know, it's very loud. You have the sounds of cars. It's a very busy highway with cars going really fast. So yeah, we did meet up with some people who had walked that part and complained about it, and we said, oh, we didn't do it, we did the alternative, and they hadn't known about the alternative and they had wished that they had done that.
But Elle has done both and was quite adamant again that the alternative was better. We took the alternative. It was on an asphalt road, but it was much quieter. There were only a couple cars past us you know, in however long we were on there, 45 minutes or something. And the second thing that I did mention was the elevation change. What did you think of that?
Yeah, it's interesting because I think I've said before that I kind of like hill walking, you know, unusual in that way. I recognize that most people don't like going up hills or find it difficult to go up hills. For me, it's partly a plantar fasciitis thing. It hurts a lot less if I'm having problems with plantar fasciitis. It's better for my feet to be flexed in that way when they're climbing up than if I'm going flat. But also, yeah, I don't know. Even before we started doing Caminos, we were living in Switzerland and we were doing a lot of hiking up in the mountains, like in the Alps, you know, pretty serious hiking where you do have to do a lot of up and down. So I guess we're kind of used to that. We also live in Lisbon, which is a very hilly city. So we're used to climbing up and down hills just in our daily lives. So hills don't really faze me or bother me, but I got the impression that they were difficult for our friends who we were walking with and also for other pilgrims who we met along the way.
Yeah, I would agree. I didn't have any problems really myself with the hills, but I did sort of think that it was hillier probably than typically the last 100 kilometers of other Caminos. Although coming out of Orense on the Sanabres is a huge hill. And so we didn't have anything quite like that,
as
I recall
yeah.
from last year, because I was coming out of COVID and it was like the first part of the first day that we had decided to start walking again. But yeah, it's a bit hilly, sure. I don't think it's something to put people off. It's not the Primitivo, it's not the Salvador. But yeah, maybe it's more hilly than the last 100 kilometers of the Frances. I think that's probably true.
Yeah, I would say that's probably true. I don't remember the Frances really being hilly at all. But then I don't remember the Frances all that well. We need to go back and do the Frances one of these days.
Out of season, definitely.
Yeah.
And the final thing just regarding practicalities is that, you know, when we started, because we were perhaps off stage the first 2 days, we didn't see a lot of pilgrims. And then maybe because of the joining with the route from A Coruña and because we were getting back on stage for the second half, we suddenly came across a lot more pilgrims and then we got into a bit of a bed race.
We did. And we talked amongst ourselves and realized this is actually the first bed race experience we've ever had on a Camino. It's not a particularly pleasant thing, I would have to say. I'd prefer not to have that stress of, you know, worrying about if you're going to get a bed that night. In the end, we did get a bed, but only because we went off route. If we had gone to Bruma, which is the typical in stage, well, there are only two albergues, one of which is private, and it was already full even the day before when we checked. So then the only option was the Xunta albergue, and from talking to other pilgrims, we've realized that it filled up before we would have arrived there. So we would have been left without a bed if we had gone to Bruma. Instead, we took the decision to turn off and go to another kind of nearby town. And we got a two-bedroom apartment for the four of us. So that actually worked out great in the end. But yeah, it was stressful. And I up until that point, I really didn't think there were many people on the Camino. But then that day, they suddenly like popped out of the woodwork from everywhere. And all these people started passing us. And when we would be in a cafe taking a break, we'd see all these people walking by. And then we'd be like, oh, no, we have to go. And that added a bit of stress to the day.
Yeah, it's funny looking back at it in hindsight, because we all, I think, left early. Especially those people who were hoping for a Xunta albergue bed. And so, yeah, everybody was kind of on the trail at the same time. And we knew that the albergue had 22 beds. And then we were really counting the people. We were like, oh, okay, we've seen 12 people already. And we're four. So that's almost capacity. But we don't know. Are those people going to the other albergue? Maybe they've got a reservation. So that frees up two more beds at the Xunta albergue. And so it was funny, yeah, because when we did the Frances in 2017, there were quite a lot of people, but I guess, I don't know if bed race wasn't a real thing then, or maybe we just got lucky that we didn't go at one of those times. One of the things we've been learning through the Camino de Santiago Forum is that the Frances bed race is very specific to specific times. And just very recently, because it was the May Day holiday around the beginning of the Frances, it was absolutely packed and people couldn't get beds at all. But so we didn't have that experience on the Frances. And then obviously when we're doing these other Caminos like the Nascent and etc., there aren't even any albergues anyway. So there's, right. there's no bed race really to be had. It's more trying to find, is there actually accommodation
yeah.
where you're trying to stop? That's the challenge that we've had mm-hmm. with accommodation for the most part the last couple of years, rather than everybody trying to get to the same spot.
Right. Yeah. So that has been a stress factor as well. On other Caminos, we've had to call at least a couple of days in advance to see, you know, is this place open and to try to work out if there is a place where we can stay. There always was in the end. We always figured out a way to do it, but sometimes it was a bit tricky and we'd have to walk further or walk not as far as we had wanted to. But yeah, this was a different experience and not the one that I would particularly like to repeat. So yeah, if we do the Frances again, I think it will be definitely off season.
And the thing was that this town of Bruma, that's the second to last night before you hit Santiago. And because there was only the two albergues in the next end of stage destination for the next day in Sigueiru, there were 8 albergues listed in Gronce. And so we thought, oh, okay, we've gone from 2 to 8. So the bed race is over and now we're sweet. And it was funny because we went really quickly by our standards that day before while we were on the bed race. And the next day we didn't book and we said, okay, there's loads more beds. We're all fine. And so we did, it was a similar distance, but we arrived much later or a couple of hours later, let's say, because we didn't have that push of the bed race. And then we found it difficult that night also.
Yeah, they were mostly full. Some of them were totally full. Some of them had, you know, just a couple of beds left and we needed 4 beds. So we had to do some calling and some running around town. You were calling and I was running around town and there was lots of confusions because sometimes we were talking to the same person at the same time and didn't realize it. In the end, we got 4 beds in an albergue. But yeah, there was a bit of, we didn't realize at the time that it was a bed race, but there was a bit of a shortage for accommodation that night too.
But one of the things that we hadn't taken into account or hadn't considered, which somebody told you later, was that some other people on other Caminos, if they can't get a bed in Santiago, they might go to Sigueiru, taking a taxi or a bus or something and stay there. And so it's sort of, yeah, because we were thinking, look at the capacity of all of these albergues. If you count up the beds, it seems to be way more beds than the number of people that we've seen on this Camino. Mm-hmm. So yeah, that was just a lesson to maybe that we should have booked or we should have thought about that a little bit in advance. But in the end, we got beds, so it was all fine.
Yeah, and particularly because there was a festival going on in Santiago or just outside of Santiago. So accommodation was definitely at a premium, which we had found out a few weeks ago when we first looked into accommodation and we luckily were able to get something. But, you know, it does make sense what that person had said, that people who couldn't find affordable accommodation in Santiago would then go to Sigueiru because that was the nearest place that had albergues that would have, you know, a reasonably priced bed.
All right, and to finish up, we'd just like to talk about the Camino Inglés and put it in context a little bit with the other Caminos that you can do in Galicia or with the last 100 kilometers of those Caminos. It's something we've mentioned before, the idea of a complete Camino, and maybe that doesn't really exist and that's neither here nor there. But I think in the modern, yeah, my own view in the modern world is that a start point for a Camino is a real thing, even if in the medieval world it wasn't. You just walked out of your house. And so the thing that's attractive, I think, for a lot of people, including us, for the Camino Inglés is that it's a full Camino that's the 100 kilometer or a little bit over 100 kilometers. And so that gives an interesting alternative because people are always asking, you know, I've only got 5, 6 days, 7 days to walk. I want to finish in Santiago. I want to get a Compostela. What should I do? And the Inglés is an interesting option.
It is. Yeah. It is a complete Camino that is a short Camino. So,
and it's the only one, unless you count going backwards from Finisterre, which I don't really. So the other alternatives for a similar length Camino finishing in Santiago are to start from Sarria on the Frances, from Tui or Valença or Vigo on the Portuguese. I think those are the two most common for sure. Orense maybe on the Sanabres, I don't know how many people do that. From Lugo on the Primitivo, I don't think there's much point. All the best of the Primitivo is behind Lugo. And what I thought was interesting is that we did see quite a few first-time pilgrims, including Haley and Samantha, who were with us, but other pilgrims that we talked to. And I was curious about that because I feel like they had chosen that specifically instead of Saria on the Frances, which is the most popular starting point for any Camino by a huge margin. And so they had maybe thought about that and read some things maybe which had said, okay, there's a huge number of pilgrims here and it's a little bit difficult. It's not really the perhaps the spirit of the Camino that much. And so here's this alternative to walk the Inglés, and you walk a full Camino, you get a Compostela, and it's a bit more calmer, let's say, than the Frances. And so I found that encouraging because we've talked before about how there has to be some kind of solution to having so many people on the Frances at certain times and having these crazy bed races, even though we've just described a bed race, but having a bed race day after day after day, mm-hmm. and having people not be able to find beds where you have these other routes that are empty. And so I do think we need to spread our pilgrims out a little bit more. And so the Inglés has sort of emerged, I think, really in the last few years, maybe even coming out of the pandemic, as a good option for the last 100 kilometers.
Yeah, and I'd say, you know, if those are the two things that you're comparing, walking from Sarria or walking from Ferrol, then I would choose walking from Ferrol on the Inglés. I'm not a huge fan of the last 100 kilometers of the Frances because it is such a shocking change from what the rest of the Frances is up until that point. And I find the Inglés much more appealing in that way. Now, if you want to broaden that and say, oh, is it better than starting in Twi, or is it better than starting in Lugo or Orense, then I'm not sure. I mean, you would have to weigh those up. But the fact that it is a full, complete Camino that's, you know, just over 100 kilometers and still has a really nice balance, I think, of a good number of pilgrims, so you do get the spirit of the Camino, you meet other pilgrims, you meet locals along the way who are supporting pilgrims, but, you know, you don't have the hordes that you have on the Frances. So I think it's a good option for first-timers.
Yeah, I would agree. And if I were ranking, as I tend to do, I think the Portuguese from Twi would still be probably my number one choice. Mm. If someone were saying to me, what should I do? I've got these 5-6 days or whatever to walk and I want to finish in Santiago, I think that would be my number one. And I think maybe the Inglés would be number two.
Okay.
And, you know, I think the other thing is we've walked, you know, in Galicia quite a lot. This was our first time in Northern Galicia. But one of the things that we were noting as we were walking the Inglés was that, you know, if you're a first time pilgrim or you haven't been to Galicia before, or you haven't spent much time in Spain, you know, all the things that are typical of that region you get. You get mm-hmm. the cities with the galerias, you get the orios that you can see in the countryside, you get interesting forests and you know, greenery and flowers and all this kind of stuff. And so maybe, yes, because we've done this quite a few times, that was less exciting for us. Mm-hmm. But yeah, as a first Camino, I think the facilities are there in terms of albergue. The signage is good. And you get the Galicia experience. Mm-hmm. And like you said, the people are friendly, the local people, they're not jaded by our presence as they sometimes are, let's say, on the Frances. And so, yeah, I think it can be a really good option for the last 100 kilometers.
As long as you don't mind asphalt.
All right. And so with that, we are done for the Camino Inglés for now, but we'll be back soon to talk about a different kind of Camino that we're about to undertake. So until then, buen camino.
And bon camino.
Thanks for listening. For more great content about the Camino de Santiago, visit our website at spiritofthecamino.com and follow us on Facebook and Instagram at Spirit of the Camino. Buen camino. Buen camino.